All right, welcome to our AFF event for July of
2016.
I'm Chris Spangle. Thank you all for coming out. We're going to be talking about criminal justice reform tonight. We put together a panel of Jason Pye. He is the Director of Communications for FreedomWorks. And Richard Samuels, who is, what's your title? You're the founder of Growing Indy.
Yes.
And Brent Eaton, who is a prosecuting attorney in Hancock County. And Rob Kendall will be our moderator. Rob is from Central Indiana today in Brownsburg, W-Y-Z-R-X.
Y-R-Z.
Y-R-Z.
You were close.
So,
you've been on the show like 30 times.
Yeah. you can tune in on, what's your website?
W-Y-R-Z.org, or 98.9 if you're in the Central Indiana area.
Wow, so, you really suck at intros.
Really.
This is Jason. Jason. Hi. I'm going to turn it over to Rob. Basically, Rob has a set of questions that he's going to ask, and then we'll do a little Q&A with the crowd later on. So, Rob, take it away.
Yeah, so I guess my first question to you guys is, Indiana had what a lot of people called some landmark changes to its criminal justice system the past couple of years. Greg Sterwald, the state rep, was one of the authors of that bill, to try to put an onus on keeping violent offenders in prison and trying to put more treatment programs in place for what are called low-level offenders. I would just be curious, nationally, if you guys feel, and obviously you deal with this on a local level in Hancock County, whether we're putting the right amount of emphasis on keeping the right people behind bars.
I think in most states, there are 32 states that have done what we call justice reinvestment initiatives. It started in Texas in 2007. Texas was facing a roughly $547 million cost for prison construction that year, and then $2 billion through 2012. And rather than build new prisons, Texas did, chairman of the Corrections Committee, Jerry Madden, went to the speaker and said, this is what we're facing, $2 billion over the long term. What should we do? And the speaker said, don't build new prisons. They cost too much. And so rather than spending $547 million, what they did was they invested about $250 million in a justice reinvestment initiative, basically focusing on drug courts, putting people who have addiction problems through these drug courts where they can graduate and eventually have reentry programs where they can go out and be successful, taxpaying, productive citizens. And over the time, it's worked. Texas has averted, to date, about $3 billion in corrections costs. That's prison expansion, new construction costs. They have seen crime rates drop by 21%. They have the lowest crime rates they've had since 1968. That itself defines success, and not just the cost aversion from a fiscal conservative perspective. And you also look at recidivism. Recidivism is the rearrest rate after 3 years. I think in Indiana, you guys define it as the reincarceration rate after 3 years, I believe. But the rearrest rate after 3 years dropped by 9% from, I think, 32% to 23%, which is extraordinarily low. The national average is about, thank you, the national average is about 38 to 40%. So Texas has really set the path for justice reinvestment initiatives, and other states have taken it up. And it's predominantly Republican states like Georgia and South Carolina, Utah, Mississippi's even done some of this stuff. Recently, Oklahoma got rid of its three strikes laws, which is extraordinary. But I think we continue to need to have an emphasis on diverting low-level nonviolent offenders into treatment programs, into rehabilitative programming, and even people who are in prison, even violent offenders. Can anybody take a guess how many people who go into jail will eventually come out? Any guesses in the audience?
95%.
I hate you.
Right.
Brett knows that. Brett knows this because he's heard this before. He came to a blogger summit we hosted at FreedomWorks last month. So, yeah, it's 95-96%. So, regardless of whether they're violent offenders or nonviolent offenders, we have to focus on rehabilitation, and that includes giving them education training, their work training, putting them on a path where they can be successful, and also upon reentry. Record sealing, expungement, ban the box are also things that we can do. Ban the box is eliminating the criminal history box and job applications. So these guys can go back into society, become taxpaying citizens, and end that cycle of crime and poverty that comes with a criminal record.
Interesting.
Well, I don't have the facts and figures, but I feel that the criminal justice system definitely... it needs to be overhauled. simply because I think we're putting an extreme burden on the county jail system. The county jail system is just full and overcrowded. We are sending offenders to Elkhart at $20 million a pop. You know what I mean? It's just crazy. And so we shouldn't have to spend that type of money. Programs are great. I would love to see people who can be rehabilitated. And as I was sharing with my prosecutor friend here earlier, having been there sleeping next to some people, there are some people who just will not be rehabilitated. I think that we have to concentrate on the mental health issues. There are too many mental health issues that are just going unchecked. No one is taking the time. When offenders are released, they're just released, and that's it. You know, you have probation, you have parole, you have these entities, but no one is talking about the issues that got them where they're in the first place. And until we address those issues, there's going to continue to be problems, and there's going to be recidivism. And
hi, my name is Brent Eaton. I'm a prosecutor of Hancock County. I've worked in the justice system as a prosecutor. Let's see here. I started in 2002. I was a prosecutor in 2002, 3, 4, 5, and 6. I then was a defense attorney from 2006 until 2014. And I've now been a prosecutor in 2015 and 2016 as the elected prosecutor of Hancock County, Indiana. For those of you that may not be familiar, Hancock County, Indiana is directly east of here. We have a population of about 70,000 people. And you know what? With the criminal justice reform, what's functionally happened is that people that used to go to DOC now go to a local jail. So the pool of people for limited bed spaces has increased dramatically. And so as a result of that, facilities that were built to house 150 people or 160 people or 170 people may have to hold 200 or 210 or 220. And there's not been, to this point, the funding to make up for that. Ultimately, you've got a larger pool of people to draw from. And the problem really becomes when you convict somebody of something, maybe you give them a suspended sentence and you get them to try to go to rehabilitation and treatment. And you know what? If 90% of those people do those things, that leaves 10% that doesn't. And then you get into an issue of, okay, we'll try this and we'll try this. But ultimately, there is going to be a certain percentage of people that is always going to fail. And you get to a point where you're going to have some type of consequence. And when currently in Indiana, I think most of our donut counties and most of the counties in Indiana are having this problem where we have a much larger pool of people that are eligible for the limited number of beds we have, and we don't have any more beds. And so, I mean, ultimately, criminal justice is largely a local problem. People elect a prosecutor, people elect a sheriff, people elect judges. If they like and support the vision that those people collectively have for the justice system, they can reelect them. If they don't like them, they can get rid of them and get a new person. And so, in a lot of ways, you know, national solutions are nice, but ultimately it's largely a local issue, and people can, you know, support or not support whom they wish because they are local issues. Ultimately, most people do get out, and I think most prosecutors, if they knew, they would support things that will make it less likely for people when they get out to reoffend. Every rational person will look at it and say, boy, you know, if I have to go to trial and I have to win this trial and I know when I'm done that he will, you know, the guy will go and do his time and be out and never come back, well, that's a win. That's what every reasonable prosecutor is going to want. The thing is that there's no magic wand. We can't know that. And there's some people that we can have a lot of opportunities and we can do a lot of things to try to help people, and some people don't. No matter what happens, they will reoffend.
Yeah,
and the danger there is because all these offices are elected. If you're the every day I'm heavily involved in the drug court program in Hancock County. And so one of the things we try to do is take people that are, you know, arrested with a syringe or arrested with heavy narcotic like heroin or methamphetamine. And there's a portion of the program where, you know, they will have some incarceration balanced with some treatment, balanced with some therapy and a series of other things so that we can try to take somebody that's a net consumer of government resources and try to help them become somebody that's able to stand on their own 2 feet and be a productive member of society. Going back about 10 years, I want to say we've got a 60 or 70% success rate that if they make it, then they're not arrested again within 5 years. And so we feel pretty good about what we're doing. The danger there is if you take somebody and you take a risk on somebody, and then they go out and they commit an armed robbery, well, then you look like a moron. And so there's a fair, and it is all local, and so there's a fair amount of risk that comes with it. Ultimately, on the question you asked, is currently, I think in most donut counties, there's a lot more potential offenders for beds than there are beds, and that's a substantial problem. At the same time, though, you know, it does provide us the opportunity for creative solutions to those kind of issues.
Can I just make a quick point?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. So before I came up here, this is actually my first time in Indiana. And speaking on this topic, I've studied a bunch of different states as the primary person at FreedomWorks who does criminal justice reform. But I called up a friend of mine who used to work for Ride on Crime. They're a project of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we were talking about Indiana. And she said that the JRI program, or at least the commission that was set up under Mitch Daniels back in 2012. Interestingly, Indiana did things a little bit differently than other states. A lot of other states, they increased penalties for violent offenders, like Texas and Georgia. They increased penalties for violent offenders, but they balance it out with lowering penalties for nonviolent offenses for low-level offenders, and they either get rid of some felonies or reducing them to misdemeanors or what have you. Interestingly, Indiana didn't balance it out enough, and they also didn't provide enough funding for local jails. So Indiana has done things not necessarily the wrong way, they just haven't accomplished the goal. And they need to go back, and the legislature needs to come back and start accomplishing the goal and fixing the problems that were left by those initial reforms. Another thing I'll point out related to crime. So how many of you guys watched the RNC Trump's acceptance speech? Did anybody watch it out of curiosity? I was on a... That's fair. I was on an airplane, thank God. But I did read it, and I got an email from Reason Magazine the next day, and they're like, so what did you think of Trump's speech related to crime rates? So how many of you would be surprised if I told you crime has actually been falling for the last 30 years?
Absolutely.
So that's the one thing that kind of like left me perplexed, listening to this very ominous picture of what America is right now, where crime is rising dramatically, and it's simply, 2015 may be an anomaly, but over the bigger picture, it's simply not true. Violent crime, gun-related crime is, gun homicides, excuse me, are down by 49% since 1993. This is Pew Research who says this. General violent crime is down by 75% since 1993. And again, this Pew Research, the FBI has also confirmed that. So we're seeing drops in violent crime. Even if the crime rate did go up in 2015, it doesn't mean it's a trend. 1 year does not a trend make. And during the drop in violent crime from 1993 to 2013 or 2014, there were even a couple years in a row where we saw increases in homicides, 2005 and 2006. Guess what happened in 2007? Homicides started falling again, and they've been falling ever since. So just want to put things in context, and then you talk about the person who gets released and then subsequently reoffends and maybe possibly a much more serious crime. Something I'm dealing with in the national level, thanks to David Perdue, Tom Cotton, and a bunch of other horrible senators. I said that out loud.
Let me ask this as a follow-up question. One of the biggest issues or grievances with the criminal justice system is a perceived lack of consistency, and I'd be curious to start with our prosecutor here. Is there a lack of consistency? How hard is it to make sure that each person is sentenced at least in a fairly similar manner for a crime? King's going to take it first.
Give me that damn thing. So there are two instances of people I can give you that were sentenced far above what they should have been sentenced. So Sharonda Jones. Sharonda Jones was a low-level player in a drug ring based somewhere in Texas. I want to say Houston, but I don't remember. She was recently commuted. Her sentence was commuted by the president. She was given sentencing enhancements for having a concealed carry license. She didn't have a weapon on her when she was arrested. She had a concealed carry license. Her prison term was life. Life. She was a nonviolent offender. She was given a sentencing enhancement for having a license. Another one is Weldon Angelos. I know Brett and Chloe have heard about Weldon Angelos. Has anybody else heard this story? There's a really great video by Generation Opportunity about Weldon Angelos and his family. Weldon Angelos was given 55 years for selling $1,000 worth of marijuana. The reason he was given 55 years is because he actually had a gun on him the first time. He didn't brandish it. He didn't fire it. Nothing like that. It's a code under federal law 924C that he was prosecuted under. But under 924C, the sentences are stacked. You get 5 years for the first offense, 25 years for each additional offense. So he was a first-time offender, one single indictment, three counts, 5 for the first one, 25 for the second one, and 25 for the third one. He was sent to jail for 55 years. Thankfully, and we don't know how this happened yet because we know he wasn't commuted, but he was released from jail after about 12 to 15 years. And he's back now. He's out advocating for sentencing reform at the federal level. So those are two people I can give you examples, real-life examples, of people who were over-sentenced, who definitely maybe should have deserved jail time. I don't disagree with that. But life in 55 years for what were essentially nonviolent offenses, and yes, if you don't brandish or fire a gun during something like that, I don't think you're a violent offender. I think it's just categorized as an example of one-size-fits-all sentencing. But those are two real-life examples of over-sentencing. We need to fix this, and this is federal stuff. This is not local stuff. This is federal issues. But we have to start addressing this, and we need to go after the people who are blocking federal sentencing reform, like Tom Cotton, David Perdue, and a few others.
We'll go to the prosecutor because I think that
you want to say
that first.
You want to say something.
And trust me, I will.
Question was just about consistency in sentencing, and there's a perception. I think a lot of what the Black Lives Matter movement is a perceived lack of consistency in sentencing. Started a national conversation. I'd be curious to get your opinion on whether there is consistency in sentencing, and if not, why there might be some discrepancies.
Well, any system run by people is inherently going to be flawed. And so, you know, every day prosecutors around the country go to court thousands of times. And prosecutors around the country do remarkable work for victims around the country every single day. And hundreds of thousands of cases are adjudicated on an annual basis. And so the vast, vast majority of prosecutors are hardworking, decent, honest people that put forth an incredible amount of effort to seek justice for victims. And when somebody is harmed, or when somebody is injured, or when their spouse is taken away from them, or their loved one's taken away from them, prosecutors are that voice to bring justice for them. And so, you know, if you're going to pour through an amount of data that's almost unlimited, I am certain in any given profession, it could be, you know, teachers or any, you know, people of a religious faith, you can find one or two people, because prosecutors ultimately have an awesome amount of power. It is the power, you know, to bring charges and the power to bring cases to trial, and that power really is an incredibly awesome responsibility. And prosecutors have a real responsibility to exercise it judiciously and to exercise it with justice in their heart to try to seek out what is truly the right thing for the people that they're trying to serve. That said, you know, if because the system allows prosecutors to have the authority that we do, given the number of prosecutors around the country, it's possible that there could be a time when somebody would make a wrong decision. That's possible. But when I look at the prosecutors around the country and the work that they do on a day-by-day basis, I'm incredibly proud to call that my profession.
When Chris introduced me, what he failed to say is I've spent 26 years of my life in the criminal justice system. So I'm from the inside of it. Consistency as far as sentencing, you're really not going to have consistency because of the fact that a lot of times it depends on whether you have a personal lawyer or a public defender. It has a lot to do
some public defenders do great work.
This is true. You're absolutely right. Some public defenders do great work. However, I don't think that it would be the choice of everyone who is not Caucasian to have a public defender. I think that nationality, I think that ethnicity plays a large part. When we get into the criminal justice system, you're talking about consistency as far as sentencing. When you look at the types of time that people are given for $10 worth of crack cocaine, and this is the reason why we're even talking about this, is because you had people flying tons of cocaine over here that are getting probation, and you got guys out here on the streets that are selling $20 bags that are getting 20 years. This is the reason why things are changing now, because it has come to everyone's attention that this is ludicrous. It doesn't make sense. And so, you know, from the perspective of someone who understands it from the inside of it, there's not going to be level playing field until a whole lot of barriers and a whole lot of attitudes are adjusted and come down. We can talk statistics, we can talk all of this, but, you know, real lives are being affected. You know, this is not just, we talk about this and we go home. You know, you got people who are incarcerated and, you know, the problem is that we don't talk about the families that are left behind of those incarcerated. You know, my wife here has spent 23 years waiting for me. You know what I mean? And not only that, she pays her taxes. She does everything that she's supposed to do right. And she's having expenditures of J-Pay, all of the privatizations that the Clinton administration brought into mandatory sentencing. You know, everybody's saying hooray for Hillary, but, you know, trust and believe. I have a problem with that because I understand what Bill Clinton brought to us.
Predators.
Absolutely. And so I just think that, we have to truly get a handle and understand. Go right ahead. I see.
You know, with public defenders, though, it's the same thing. As I deal with lawyers every day, I dealt with lawyers all day. I was in court this afternoon. And, you know, before I'm in court, the lawyers come to me and, hey, well, what are we going to do on this? What is the offer on that? Are we going to have a trial? Are you willing to bend or not? Well, no, Jeff, we're going to go to trial, whatever it's going to be. But they don't come to me and say, hey, this is my private client, so give me a better deal on this. And these are my public defender clients, and so, you know, whatever. No, I've not had one case that I can recall where the lawyer that, you know, most of the time the lawyers are in the local community. Mm-hmm. Most of the time they're people that you practice with. Most of the time they're people you see in the social circles or in town. And, you know, they'll have cases, and some cases have to get tried, and some cases can be resolved. But it's not something where it's perceptible from the perspective I have that, you know, Jeff or Cody will say, hey, these are my public defender cases in this stack, and these are my private pay cases in this stack. Oh, because I'm getting, you know, because I'm a public defender here, well, then I'm not going to do this deposition. I mean, that's just, every person is different. And every public defender and every public defender system and every community is different, how they fund things or how they're going to determine funding or what resources they're going to give or if they're going to allow the public defender to take those depositions or do that discovery. And so I can't speak for the country as a whole because I don't know every community. But generally speaking, and, you know, that's from the prosecutor's perspective, that's what happens. As the lawyers come to us and maybe they want to have a trial, maybe they don't. But it's not as if it's so transparent as is the case. That's not to say it's impossible for it to happen.
Man.
I don't know. I don't know every single person's lawyer mayor. I don't. But from the perspective that where we are, that's just not how it happens. Yeah. I know that in my own personal background, I had a period of time where I did do some public defender work, and you've got a client, and you listen to your client, and you do your best for your client. Sometimes you get into trouble because you've got a caseload where things become very difficult, but that becomes an issue of how they fund that. And so, you know, it's anytime you have human beings, you're going to have errors, and you're going to have a human error rate. But, you know, I think that that's inherent within any system that has people operating.
And when you have human beings and you have errors, errors are those that land people in prison on the death penalty, for the death penalty, and they're innocent. That's a scary possibility. But as far as the public defenders are concerned, and I think that you really hit it with the last part of what you were saying, their caseloads are so heavy that it's almost to the point where plea bargaining is the first thing out of their mouth. You know, they're trying to dispose of their cases. And I understand that, you know, of course, they're going to ask certain questions and they're going to do their due diligence. But for the most part, if you look at the majority of cases, they're plea bargained out and the people who are their plea bargained to really don't even understand what it is that's happening to them until they're incarcerated. And then they look back and say, wow, and I worked for 5 years in the law library. And I've, you know, countless guys coming back to me saying, well, I didn't know this, and the public defender never told me this, and is this what they could do? They had no idea what was happening until it was like, well, just sign right here on the plea bargain, and their main thing is to try to get as less time as possible. And then, of course, you know, the advent of the habitual criminal. You know, there are certain things that they threaten you with on a regular basis. I don't care if you, especially if you're a repeat offender, you go in front of any kind of judge, if you're a repeat offender, just like if you're looking at television and they say somebody did this, the first thing that they're going to plaster across the screen is all of the things that he did 20 years ago. You know, and they want to make it look as ugly as possible so that it's justified in whatever conclusion that they come to. I'm not saying that some public defenders are not good at what they do. I'm not saying that they're inadequate in any way. What I am saying is that their caseloads are so heavy that most of the time they don't have the time to put the due diligence in. We don't have a dream team. You know, I'm not going to get a dream team. You know what I mean? I'm not going to get the type of defense that I deserve because, and that every single individual deserves. And so, that's all.
So, two things real fast. Plea deals are actually, you said majority, it's actually much more than that. It's a vast majority. In some states, it's as high as 90%, if not over 90%. That's how many cases are pled out. That in and of itself is concerning. And the reason a lot of those cases are pled out is because many people, especially people who are poor and from underrepresented communities, can't afford attorneys. They go with indigent defense. But the prosecutors, and no offense to you, I understand you're doing your job, but prosecutors hang over their heads these lengthy mandatory minimum sentences. You look at the mandatory minimum for crack cocaine. It used to be a 100-to-1 disparity for crack cocaine. Now it's 18-to-1 thanks to the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. At the federal level, it's been reduced. But it's still a disparity. But you hang over someone's head for selling a few grams of crack cocaine, a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence is, they're going to plea down. They're going to plea out. And they're going to plead guilty and they're going to go to jail and do their time less than a mandatory minimum sentence. There was one of the first commissioners or chairman of the U.S. Sentencing Commission noted that it's often the low-level players who get the lengthy mandatory minimum sentences, not the drug kingpins. That's concerning. And this guy was appointed by Ronald Reagan in the 80s when the U.S. Sentencing Commission was founded. And another thing that I want to note real fast and as an aside, because I recently at FreedomWorks on our Facebook page, facebook.com/FreedomWorks, I had the opportunity to interview two U.S. attorneys, former U.S. attorneys, Matt Orwig and Brett Tolman. And Brett Tolman was appointed by Bush. He served in Utah. Orwig served in Texas. He was also appointed by Bush. And the notion that it's not just human error, it's not just that our justice system is crafted by humans and we have prosecutors who are human. We have guys who go after people and they constantly go after people simply because if they don't spend the money they have in their budget, they're not going to be able to get that increase they want next year. And I'm not saying that's widespread. There are a few bad apples in the bunch, and I'm not trying to carte blanche say this is the problem with the entire system. But these guys, they justify their budgets based on the number of cases they get and the number of people they prosecute. This is what happens when you have 5,000 federal criminal statutes and up to 400,000 regulations that carry criminal penalties. That is our federal criminal justice system. We have an over-criminalization problem. We have an over-sentencing problem. And the justice system, in my opinion, we need a complete recodification of what our federal criminal system is, and then also to go through and just completely smash the regulatory state and eventually start rebuilding it up to the point where it's not criminalizing everybody. There is not one person in this room who hasn't committed a federal crime. Absolutely. Myself included. Has anybody shared their Netflix password with someone? You've committed a federal crime, according to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
So did my nieces and nephews.
Yeah. This is how widespread this is the problem is. So, congratulations, you're all criminals.
Let's go into victimless crimes, quote unquote, victimless crimes, drugs, prostitution, things like that. We have certain states now that are just blatantly ignoring federal law, and I would be curious how we start to deal with victimless crimes. Are we seeing a change in this? And I'd be curious to start here from a prosecutorial perspective. Is there such a thing as a victimless crime?
Well, I want to jump back just a second. Is when the criminal code changed in Indiana. We don't have nearly as many mandatory minimums as we used to. And so pretty much most everything you're going to see is pretty much suspendable. And so that's a different animal than what it was before the change.
Speaking more nationally.
And I guess to be clear for people here, you know, there's the federal system. The federal system is run by the federal government. And then your system that most people in the vast majority of criminal cases are involved in the state system. The state system then is going to be devolved down into your county with your county prosecutors and judges. And in the state of Indiana, you know, you're okay, murder, you've got a minimum on that. But most things, and this is really probably the most dramatic change that occurred, is that most everything now is suspendable. And so that's just not the reality of the day-to-day of what we have now.
I disagree, because and of course, if you're talking about first-time offenders...
The stuff that we deal with...
If you're talking first-time offenders, but if you've got a criminal history, then you're not suspendable. Automatically, you're not going to get anything suspended if you've got a previous crime. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
All right, let's go on to victimless crimes. I'd be curious to get your thoughts. Is there such a thing as a victimless crime, and is the sentencing and prosecution of that, is that a fair thing, and where are we at with that?
The priority for the beds in the justice system should be for those crimes and for those people that cause direct harm to other people. The people that cause physical harm are the ones that we should try to put in there first. The ones that may cause, you know, property damage crime are the ones we should probably try to put in there second. The ones, you know, if I come over to your house and I break all of your stuff, well, you know what? I probably should be in jail. If I come over to your house, I break all your stuff and I beat the crap out of you, I probably should be in jail, right? Now, if I, at the same time, we have a pretty big opiate heroin problem in most communities in central Indiana. And we know when someone shows up and it's a syringe and you look at their history and you can tell what's going on and somebody's been arrested and you can just, you know that they probably used heroin in the previous 48 hours. And if we turn around and let them out on a very low bond right away, you very well may be sending them off to die, because they will get out and they will use. And we've had more than a few people that have had that, and they don't come back to the next hearing because they overdose and die. And so initially there may be a reason to have a higher bond on those people. And then you may be able to do something to help get into treatment or help them recover. Potentially you can. But initially when they come in, well, are you okay? You look at it, and I understand that you call it a victimless crime. But if you're the prosecutor and you look at that and you see that person and think, you know, I think there's a really good chance they have a substance abuse problem, sure, I'll agree to release them on their own recognizance, and then Ms. Smith doesn't come back because she overdosed and she died. Well, then have you done your job? I don't think you have. And so, you know, there's a lot of very difficult issues when you deal with substance abuse. And so, you know, I don't think that there's a one-size-fits-all solution, but I certainly do think that with methamphetamine and with heroin, that treatment and helping those people to become useful, productive members of society should be part of the equation and what we attempt to do.
So, heroin has been around for how long?
Decades.
Hundreds of years. Okay. So all of a sudden, we are in the needle-sharing program. We've got programs for, you know, where people can go and get help and all of this. This is not new. So why didn't we have these programs before when all of the blacks were dying from heroin? All of a sudden, we've come up with all of these alternatives, okay? But my thing is, this is not new. This has been going on for decades and decades and decades. But all of a sudden, now that it has affected the white population, all of a sudden now, it becomes, we have to have a needle-sharing program. We have to have this. We have to have that. Something to think about. I wonder where all of that was when everybody else was doing the exact same thing. Okay? Heroin has been here. Heroin is not new. Crack cocaine is not new. This stuff is not new. All of a sudden, these programs are popping up. Because now it's happening to people that they don't want it to happen to. It's that simple. You can say what you want. Here's the thing. I'm going to tell you a story about my mom. My mom is an offender. At the age of 76, she had a dog tied up in her yard. Okay, it wasn't even her dog. It was my sister's dog, her daughter. My sister moved away. The dog was there. Hey, we fed it. You know, make sure the dog eats. No problem. Got a chain on. Well, the dog had pulled at its collar for a long time. The neighbors that moved in decided, oh, this is animal cruelty because the dog has some blood on his collar. Do you know that they called animal control? They came and they locked my mother up. They gave her a number. And they had her on probation. And she had to go and do piss tests on a regular basis. This is an old lady, okay? And it was because she could not afford an attorney. Where was I? The dutiful son? I was incarcerated. Okay, so I was there doing my due diligence, what I should be doing. It's just crazy. You know, it seems like every year they create more and more laws to make sure that there are reasons to lock people up. People who are not doing anything when you talk about victimless crimes. And I just think that it behooves us to really start thinking about the things that our state government and our legislature do in our name. And this is why I advocate more than anything when I'm dealing with ex-offenders. The first thing that I say to them when they come home is, are you registered to vote? I think that, you know, and it's just my personal opinion, that no ex-offender should be allowed back into the community unless it's mandatory that they're registered to vote. Because if you want to get back into this game, then you have to be able to vote. I don't care who you vote for. I just want to make sure that you have that right and that you understand what that right means, because too often we are allowing the people who, quote unquote, have been there too long to continue to do the things that need to change. And I think that this is why we're seeing this circus of a political farce, that's what I call it. The less choosing the lesser of two evils when we're dealing with Trump and we're dealing with Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, it's scary and where we're going right now. And so I just hope that we can do better than this.
So I'm going to take my FreedomWorks hat off for a second. Sorry, I'll move it away. I'm going to take my FreedomWorks hat off for a second. Is everybody cool with that? This is just Jason Fly, the guy talking. Because this is actually a really tricky subject for me.
Everything you say can and will be used against you.
Always.
Are you? You're going to use this against me?
No, I'm
just kidding. You're the prosecutor. Yeah. No. So, like, I'm a rarity. I'm a libertarian who's actually never smoked pot. I'm the unicorn, apparently. The libertarian. Yeah. So, one thing I want to say, like, I don't. People who commit victimless crimes personally, I mean, one, I think it should be a state issue. There is no reasonable justification for the federal government to be involved in the regulation of drugs. I think states should handle it. As you mentioned before, states handle the vast majority of criminal cases. We have roughly 200,000 people in the federal prison population. We have 2.2 million people in total incarcerated across the United States. It's predominantly handled on the local level. States should be handling this. Now, to put my FreedomWorks hat back on, one thing you were talking about, you mentioned Clinton before in the 94 crime bill.
Yes.
And it's a completely legitimate criticism. I look at the 86 crime bill and the 94 crime bill. The interesting thing, and I said this recently, it was a progressive radio host, I think, in Cleveland, and I was talking, he blamed Republicans for the vast majority of like tough on crime laws. And I was like, wait, hold on a second. The Congressional Black Caucus supported the 1986 crime bill. The Congressional Black Caucus largely, if not unanimously, voted for the 94 crime bill. This has been a bipartisan problem. It's a biracial problem. Everybody's guilty here in terms of creating this issue, this problem. And so just want to add that.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
And then the final thing, talking about heroin. So recently, Kelly Ayotte, the senator from New Hampshire, she's vulnerable, and there's a heroin epidemic in New Hampshire. It was well documented during the Republican primary there. She tried to attack on an amendment to the National Offense Authorization Act. What that has to do with drugs, I don't know. But she tried to attack on an amendment to the NDAA that would criminalize 0.5 grams. This is possession. This is possession. This is not drug trafficking. This is possession. 0.5 grams, less than a gram, of any drug containing trace amounts of fentanyl. Now, fentanyl is a powerful opiate. It's the one that killed Prince. And they typically use it for surgical. It's more. It's like 40 or 50 times more powerful than morphine. But the problem is with Ayotte's amendment wasn't the fact that she was going after fentanyl. It's the fact that fentanyl is not added to heroin in the United States. It's added. It gets imported from South America. It goes through Mexico. It gets added predominantly in Mexico. Even the DEA has said this. It gets added in Mexico, and then it makes its way to the United States. Very rarely do you find instances in which fentanyl is added to heroin inside the United States. Okay. So we would have locked people up for 5 years for containing less than a gram of any drug containing fentanyl. It's ridiculous. That's a drug treatment problem. That's an addiction problem. That's not a drug trafficking problem. People are... I just want to know, like... The victimless crime thing as it relates to heroin and crack cocaine, things like that, I think treatment programs work better if you're going to keep it criminalized. If you're not going to keep it criminalized, let states decide whether the criminality of any sort of drug, recreational or not, exists. Personally, I think the one person who's probably come around on this the most is Ted Cruz. Boo him if you want because of his RNC speech, if not, great. But Ted Cruz has come around on this saying that like at least marijuana states should be able to regulate. So that's kind of where personally I am.
Let's get some questions from the audience. Anybody have a question? Just raise your hand. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, first off, to the gentleman that was incarcerated, I'm sorry, I don't know his name.
Richard.
I understand from your standpoint that you see it as when white people find out, then all of a sudden gets done. But I promise you this, I'm here tonight because I'm just finding out. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. That's not everybody, but I'm just... You know, I understand where you're coming from, and I'm not saying that you're wrong.
And
I'm just telling you, I just found out. It's just becoming apparent to me, and that's why I'm here this evening.
And you know, glad that you're here. And you know, don't take it as an attack.
No, I'm not.
Because it's not. It's just the facts.
It's a discussion.
Right, and you know, me and my white friends sit down and we talk all the time. All the time. We we go back and forth and we go back and forth. And because the bottom line is at the end of the day, we understand that most of the things that happen are based upon the fact that we're allowing things to happen. You know, and voting is a big deal. It is a big deal. It's one of the biggest deals. And because if you were not, most of the people are concerned about the national level, but it's the local level when it really, really counts in your home state right here. You know, if you allow certain individuals or certain entities to get into office, then things are not going to change. It's just going to be the Good Old Boy Network all over again. Okay. And until we address that, which is what my organization is trying to do. Part of my organization is to unite ex-offenders as they come home and to create a voting base that will change the political climate of the city of Indianapolis as well as everywhere else, because we don't have a voice. When you're talking what the LGBT community did, you know, I'm taking a page out of their book and looking at what's possible. Okay, and for me, if I can get 200,000 people to say, no, we're not going to do that, that makes a difference. And people will start listening. And then, but at the same time, when you get people to listen, you have to have a plan. And so therefore, you've got to have something put in place already. And these are my growing pains. These are the things that I'm learning. Having spent 26 years in prison, it's difficult for me to now navigate the technology. There are so many things. People talk about the programs and things that they have out here. I sit on the board of several different places. I work with the Marion County Reentry Coalition, the MCRC, as well. Unfortunately, there is so much funding that's being tossed around that never reaches the clients. Okay? You have a client that'll come in looking for aid and assistance, and the first thing that's shoved at them is an application. And when that application is filled out, we'll get back to you. Okay? Now we have the piece of paper that says we've served someone. And so this is how we get our grant money. So now whether we serve you or not, it doesn't matter because we get our grant money. Okay, this is what's happening with boots on the ground. We can have conversation about all of this other stuff, but people that need real help out here that are really, really struggling, it's a problem. And a lot of people don't like my opinions because usually I don't fiddle-faddle around with them. I just simply say what it is, because this is just what it is. And, you can give me 1,000 reasons why you can call it something else, but at the end of the day, people are struggling.
Let's go ahead and take another question. We've got about 10 minutes left. Hang on just a second. I want to try to get as many people as possible. Yeah, go ahead.
Richard, what percentage of the inmates that you were incarcerated with, would you say, had diagnosable mental illnesses?
I would probably say... Oh, wow. That's a great question. I'm going to say about 35%. And that's a low number, because you have to understand, and here we are back to like it is, they closed down Central State Hospital. They just now closed down LaRue Carter. Where you think they're going? They're going to prison. Okay?
Or jail,
exactly. Right. And the thing is that and you have to understand, and my 26 years was not just straight in a row. It was in and out, in and out, in and out. And so I was in prison in the 70s. The 70s. Okay, I was in prison in the 80s. For the last 5 decades, it seems like I've always been locked up. Sorry, baby. But it just seems like I was always gone. But every time I saw a change, because they went from one bunk levels, then they stacked them, then they stacked them again. And now you have so many levels, because you have to understand when you're getting $31,000 per person, I'm trying to lock up and honestly, as a business person, I'm trying to lock up as many people as I possibly can.
And it's even worse in the private prison system, where prisoners can be $80,000 to $90,000. Prisoners are treated as commodities.
We are simply commodities to be traded. And then you have to understand, you're not even thinking about the fact that when you are released, you are still treated as a commodity, because now you're sending me to anger management. Now you're sending me to probation. Now you're sending me to do a dirty drop, to do drops, drug testing.
And a simple technical violation.
And I don't even have to have a drug offense to be drug tested every single day. And it costs me $13 every time I go. When I'm released from prison, I don't have any money. Okay? And so what do you think that I'm going to end up doing? Exactly. To pay my, I just fortunate enough, personally, that I had someone who was an anchor for me to be there, and so my life turned out a little bit better. But I look at all of the guys that I left behind, and the guys that I see on a daily basis that don't have a support system that I have, and those individuals are left floundering.
Another question? Yeah, go ahead.
So, what kind of recidivism programs guys think work and what kind are out there?
Let's let everybody have a
shout. So Texas has one. It's they actually bring in a private company, or I think it's a nonprofit, to come in and actually teach the prisoners business skills. They give them basically the equivalent of a college degree. They go out and they start their own business. The recidivism rate for this program in Texas, and I wrote about it to freedomworks.org. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the program. But the recidivism rate for that program is 7%. That is rearrest within 3 years. Only 7% of people are rearrested within 3 years. That's phenomenal. But we, job training, work training, education, those are the types of things that we want to see, the types of programs we want to see. But it's not just recidivism reducing programming in prisons that matter. It's reentry programs. Record sealing and expungement. Texas and Georgia have done phenomenal work on record sealing and expungement, especially as it relates to nonviolent offenders. And then some states are pursuing ban the box as it relates to government jobs or administrative jobs inside the public sector. I don't personally like it as a libertarian. I don't think the government should mandate that to private businesses. And then there's also a piece of legislation working its way through Pennsylvania right now called Clean Slate. If someone keeps their record clean for 10 years, their slate will be wipe clean. The only people who will be able to see it is police officers when the person is pulled over. But no job or education or housing that the person pursues, the administrators for those types of things would not see their criminal record, which is a definite positive in terms of reducing recidivism.
I'm just, right quick, I just want to talk about the word reentry. Okay, this is a word that everyone is throwing around. And this is what this word is what gets a lot of money funneling into Indianapolis and a lot of the other states. When you talk about reentry, that means that you're coming back into society. To me, the word reentry is a misnomer, okay? Because in order for me to come back into society, that means that I had to already be there once before. If I'm a criminal on the streets, I'm not part of society. I'm not abiding by the laws. And so how can I re-enter into anywhere? Okay? I've got to first be taught. We're talking about like when you go to the military, what do you get? Basic training. When you go to a job, what do you get? Orientation. So therefore, you know, before I can re-enter anywhere, before I can come back to somewhere, I have to have been part of that process. If I am a criminal, I am not part of that process. And so basically, I have to be taught what it is to be a regular citizen first before I can re-enter anywhere.
One last question. Go ahead.
How big is the problem of employers pulling extortion on people re-entering their jobs?
I haven't looked that much in the detail on it. I don't know.
Let's go ahead and take one more. Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, so on the whole inconsistency issue, going back to that, I want to recognize that Brent and his colleagues have way too much of a workload put upon them, as well as the fact that it's the Indiana General Assembly that writes all the laws. One solution I thought of, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. What if we did away with plea bargaining? You guys just prosecute the case, the public defenders defend against it. If you get convicted, there's a set amount of time you go away for, and instead we just have a conversation of, do we really need to send people away for that long for that crime?
You better get ready to build some more courts.
Well, that's what
I mean. Okay, here's reality. Is in my jurisdiction, we're going to file about between, I would say, 2,500 criminal cause numbers a year. About those 2,500 criminal cause numbers a year, approximately, say, no more than roughly 2,000, give or take, are going to be misdemeanors and low level, like level 6 felonies. That leaves, say, 300, 400, 500 of other types of crimes. Okay? We got 3 courts. Okay? This is the same caseload, roughly, within a relatively small percentage that's been in place. It's been at the same rate for about the last 10 years. It's not increased, it's not dramatically decreased. That's about roughly where we are. And so we're going to try and have trials. Maybe we're going to have 10, or we're going to have 15. We're not having 2,500. Okay? And really, that's kind of down a little bit from where it's been before, because we're not generating as much stuff off the traffic stops. There's a variety of reasons why there's not as much traffic generated crime as what there had been before. Frankly, a lot of that's due because people are not drinking alcohol as much as what they used to, and so you're not getting those cherry-picked DUIs like you used to have. Now those cases take a lot more effort and a lot more work, and there's not as many of them as there used to be 10 years ago. That's what we encounter in our jurisdiction. You're going to burn through a whole lot of jurors, and you know, you've got to have a judge sit on the bench, and he's got to call balls and strikes and make rulings when you're having trials. And beyond that, you know, so logistically, that's just not possible. Beyond that, you know, every statute and every situation is slightly different. If somebody gets a DUI and they're 0.08, okay, does that guy deserve the same penalty theoretically? Somebody's going 120 miles an hour and they blow a 1.4 or a 1.6 or they're 2.4? No.
Right. Well, and that's why I'm asking, instead of you and the public, or you and the defender, having that conversation. Maybe we should have that conversation as a society at the state.
Well, there's so many different, every single incident is going to be different for a variety of reasons. And there's so many different variables that are in play. It can be part of the history. It can be the specific facts of the crime. It can be that maybe somebody's going to be in a position to have a more favorable outcome because their attorney was able to suppress certain evidence and the judge found the evidence was collected illegally. And that, you know, is a fatal problem to the state's case. And so that person may get a misdemeanor instead of a felony, right? I mean, there's 101 variables that are out there. And that's just the nature of the system that we have. You know, it involves people. And anytime you involve, you know, people and human actors, you're going to have some people, they're going to make good decisions, and unfortunately, you know, you're going to have some people that won't. I don't think you want to take away all of the human element of things, because if you do that, you're going to end up with a different series of problems for people that are going to have other sentences which are out and not congruent with what they should have.
Want to close with this, and again, maybe some of our guests will stay around for a little bit if they can. Anything you guys want to promote or talk about here as we wrap up today?
I am here for work. Work paid for me to come here. So if you guys want to check out what we're doing on criminal justice, please go to freedomworks.org/justiceforall. A couple of white papers I've written. One is called Federalism in Action, How States Got Smart on Crime. It talks about Texas and Georgia and mentions some of the other states that have worked on criminal justice. One of the topics we didn't discuss tonight, because it's it's related in some respect to civil asset forfeiture. FreedomWorks is staunchly opposed to civil asset forfeiture, and we have a white paper on that called From High Seas to Highway Robbery. I would encourage you guys to read it. We also have one called the Overcriminalization Epidemic, which is about criminal intent and mens rea, which is a long-held legal principle. So please go to freedomworks.org and check that stuff out. I have business cards in the back if anybody wants to email me, and I'll be here until Brett leaves, because he's my ride.
As I said, my name is Richard Samuels. My organization is Growing Indy. I can be reached at 317-992-8236. I also have a radio show, which is called the Growing Indy Reentry Radio Show. We talk about the new laws and all of the things, the resource providers that are out there, and try to make sure that the returning citizens, which is the new watchword, not ex-offenders, that the returning citizens have options, and there are definitely certain resource providers that we direct them to, and others we say steer clear of those, because those are just basically trying to make sure that they are able to renew their grants. So,
where can we see you Saturday?
Right. Thank you so much. On Saturday, July the 30th, our organization is partnering with another organization called Peacekeepers in Indianapolis. Bishop Horatio Lester is the CEO and founder of that. And we are going to have a gathering of mothers and families who have lost loved ones to violence in the community. What I talk about the most is that we talk about a lot of the police action shootings and white cops and black victims, and what I'm promoting here on Saturday is that in order for us to really talk about anything, we have to talk about the black on black crime first, because I think that, you know, before you can tell someone else that they're doing something wrong, you have to be treating yourself better. You know, so that's kind of part of my focus on Saturday, is to talk about the fact that we have to get our community to the place where we're not killing each other before we can complain about somebody else killing us.
So where and when?
I'm
not making any money off this.
Absolutely, he's really not. We will be at School 69. It's at actually the corner of 34th and Keystone. I'm hoping and praying that it doesn't rain. We're looking to get about at least 1,000 to 2,000 people out there. I mean, we really have plugged this thing a lot. Not, trust me, don't look at my example of plugging it, because I'm not doing a great job of it. But it's 3421 North Keystone Avenue, and it'll be from 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the evening. And so we're hoping that anyone who'd like to comes out, and, you know, it's going to be an interesting, it's called Locked Arms. And definitely we're not going to, you know, be singing Kumbaya. We're going to talk about some issues.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience and listening to things tonight. One thing I did want to make sure that I mentioned is that there's, the police, when they go home, a lot of them go home to neighborhoods in the community. When the prosecutors go home, they go to homes in the community. And they want a good, safe community, probably just as much as you do, and just as much as you do. And there's a lot of room for agreement on a lot of these issues, and I think there's a lot of room for there to be consensus, for there to be a lot of cooperation. And ultimately, in court, when I'm in front of a jury or when I'm dealing with people in public, tone matters. The way that you communicate with people matters. And we can communicate in such a way that we can build bridges or walls in everything we do. And I think this is an important enough issue where we all be well served to try to build some bridges so that we can do good things for the country that we all love.
Well said.
Absolutely.